you know, let's make it Sunday school for a second. Say all truth is God's truth. So if all truth is God's truth, then all things are theological. And then that means that everything becomes a starting point or a conversation partner, which truly excites me. You know, right now I'm doing a lot of reading on the concepts of death, dying, suffering, and you know, what does the theological project have to bear in those areas of life?
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the CPT Podcast. I'm Zach Wagner. Today our guest is Dr. Jared Longbons, who currently serves as the pastor of Peachtree Christian Church in Atlanta, Georgia. We're talking with Jared about his story of becoming a pastor theologian, growing up in the space between Catholicism and Protestantism, his PhD research on the doctrine of creation, and lessons learned from life and ministry. And we are going to jump into the conversation right now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the CPT Podcast. We are excited to have Jared Longbons joining us today. Jared is a member of the St. Peter Fellowship of the CPT. Welcome, Jared. Good to have you on today.
It's good to be here. Delighted to see both of you.
Yeah. So this is one of our Get to Know One of Our CPT Fellows podcasts. Just want to take the opportunity to have a conversation with Jared and learn a bit about him and his journey, his theological interests, his ministry setting. So, Jared, why don't you begin just by telling us a bit about where you grew up, your family situation, a little bit about your story of faith.
I grew up right in the middle of Illinois. Central Illinois is the region that we call it. And my mom grew up in a tradition called the Church of God, Anderson, Indiana. It's kind of a holiness movement, part of the Wesleyan background. And my dad grew up Roman Catholic, very devout. And I always describe my life as being half Protestant in that regard and half Catholic, kind of a strange mashup of backgrounds. And ultimately, I became an independent Christian church guy, which means something in particular, but ultimately, there's a larger American tradition called the Restoration Movement or the Stone Campbell Movement. It's the first indigenous American Christianity. You will hear of groups called Disciples of Christ or just Christian Church or Churches of Christ. And I ended up going to school at a place that was associated with that. And somehow through all that, I've maintained this kind of half Catholic, i.e. a sacramental sense worldview, theologically speaking, and a half what I am now, which is a pastor in the Disciples of Christ Church.
So where does a devout Roman Catholic meet a Church of God wife and court and marry? What's that story of how your parents got to know each other?
I believe steak and shake would be the answer, Joel.
That's a good answer. That's a good, where else, right?
Yeah, my dad was fresh out of high school and he had a rough upbringing with his family. And so by the time he was about 18 years old, he was basically living pretty hand to mouth in this new job. And he would go down to Steak and Shake and flirt with my mom. And that's kind of what, you know, there's a beautiful romance story there. But when I was first coming up, my family didn't go to either church. We just didn't go to church at all. In fact, I had neighbor friends. I'd go over to their house on a Saturday or on a Sunday, pardon, and found out that they were at church. And I went home and asked mom and dad what this thing called church was. It wasn't until I was a little older than my grandmother, who was the Church of God person. She passed away, and my grandfather had this superstition of his faith that, he had no faith up until this point, but he wanted to make certain that when he died, he somehow entered into the realm of heaven where he would get to see my grandmother. And so he began dragging my family to church every Sunday from that Sunday forward. Wow. My dad worked weekends, so he didn't go with us. But from that period forward, my mom and my siblings and I went with him to church until the day he died. And then it's much later on that my dad was able to join us because weekends became an off time for him. And he had the wisdom not to take us away from the tradition that we were a part of because we had a community there. And because we had a community of Sunday school, vacation Bible school, all that that goes along with church, he simply wanted us to be solid, to have a place of faith development. But he was very, very, very quick and thorough in explaining to us how the church that I grew up in was getting Catholicism wrong. And so we became the annoying kids in the youth group, where we always defending the Catholic Church against folks who really didn't know much about it. And then
was that just at home? Your dad was teaching you Catholicism? Did you go to the Catholic Church some during this period?
Yes, it was at home at the dinner table when we'd hear stuff or bring stuff home from Sunday school, right? But then my dad is also now going to the church with us, and he used to argue with.
So is this from his younger catechism as a Roman Catholic? Is that where he's sourcing this? Or yeah.
Yes, he went all the way through 18 years of age. You know, he did the altar boy work and everything else. So yeah, he was always clarifying misconceptions about the Catholic faith, whether it's you worship Mary or you pray to saints. And he was always trying to explain the nuance of what was going on in those habits and practices. And so he would argue with the Sunday school teacher at the church. And for him, it was never an issue that you could have disagreement over issues of theology. The issue was over getting your facts wrong about the point of view that you were attacking. And he really always did not, you could tell he was agitated when there was just kind of a negative, a negative prejudice against one tradition or another. So we would hear it at home, we would see it in church. And then my dad did take us to mass and fish fries and all kinds of events like that. And I would say that some of my best theological training outside of church when I was just picking up books on my own did come from more Catholic or Orthodox tenor as well.
Just to fill out the picture a little bit here, this is all in Central Illinois?
Yes.
What part of Central Illinois? I recall us talking about this once, but I've forgotten.
I was born and raised in a city called Decatur, Illinois, which is actually very, very, like, it's like very Rust Belt now. But when I was coming up, it was much more, it was thriving much more than it is now. It's dying, I would say. And then most recently, my wife and I lived in Bloomington. That's where she's from. So just 45 minutes north of there, Bloomington, Normal, Illinois.
Yep.
And so I've bounced around. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I was in Mass in Normal, Illinois, at a Catholic church when I was there visiting. That's where we go to church.
There you go. Okay, well, that was just a kind of question for my own curiosity. I was just going to comment on, and you kind of answered my question already, but growing up in this kind of, in the middle of this theological dialogue between a Catholic and then a non-Catholic tradition, that seems to me just to be a pretty unique kind of ecumenical upbringing, pretty exceptional in a lot of ways, where you have a what sounds like in many ways a charitable dialogue kind of across Christian traditions, not only taking a place in your church context, being modeled by your father, but also taking place in the home. And I guess my question is, do you feel like that set you up for a growing interest in theology and ministry and number one? And number two, how do you feel like that shaped your disposition towards differences in other theological traditions and kind of your tolerance for theological debate, such as it were?
Yeah, so I think in terms of my personality, temperament, whether you're looking at Enneagram or just like Myers-Briggs stuff, I mean, one way I like to describe a bit about myself is I've always been interested in whatever I deem to be the most important thing. That might sound silly, but like if I were going to be an actor, which is what I wanted to do before I felt called into ministry, if I were going to be an actor, it would have been very much my goal to become some sort of Oscar award-winning actor, going after the high drama more so than, say, a sitcom, right? Like, that's the most important thing. I want to devote myself to that. That's the way in which kind of my purpose kind of is follows from my temperament. And so ministry was something that I, even though I for a long time didn't realize that I was called to ministry, at least doing lay ministry was always something that was important to me. I was going to be a part of a church that was bringing this good news, and not just cognitive salvific news, but like a total change good news, the holistic nature of salvation to communities and places. And that's the most important thing. I am going to do it. Now, it wasn't until I was in school training for this that I thought to myself, well, to do that, I probably ought to get a terminal degree. Of course, I didn't know which one to get, whether it's a doctorate of ministry, a PhD, which area. I had no clue until later on. But there was this point in time where I thought that the most important thing one could do in their life was be a theologian. I mean, there was very much like I might even have thought to myself, like, what do you mean you want to do something else? There is nothing else to do. Be a theologian and fix the pipes under your sink. It's the same thing. It's all theology. I mean, this is kind of the mentality and imagination that I had. As to your second part of your question, how do I think that shaped the way I think about theological influence and dialogue? I think early on, it really did give me a charitable, generous spirit, which is why being a part of the Church of God itself was okay, because that was supposedly a unifying movement. But I think it's much more realized in the Stone Campbell tradition that I'm in now. Our founders would have said we're neither Catholic nor Protestant. And even though they were non-Catholics, they're sacramental about baptism, we're sacramental about the Lord's Supper. And if we had good theologians writing at the foundation, which is on the frontier of America, we could be speaking between Catholic and Protestant better than we do, as a sort of via media. However, we did not have great theologians back then. We just had historians and then ultimately biblical scholars. But then after I studied theology more, I'd say I now have more of a tendency to lean towards certain traditions, I favor certain traditions more as a starting point. I'm not like very reformed, for instance, and I'm interested in ancient traditions of our faith.
So take us through your educational journey, leaving home in Illinois, going off to college. At what point did this kind of idea of being a theologian start to take precedent over being an actor? I'd love to hear that story a little bit. Kind of the actor theologian is an interesting pairing. I don't know that we have a ton of those in our CPT network. So yeah, talk to us a little bit about that part of your journey.
Read Angel Mendez Montoya is a Catholic priest, and he's got a theology of food. He talks about an alimentary theology of bringing togetherness. He's from I believe he's from Mexico, and he brings together a pre-Columbian dish I'm dropping it. When you go through what I've been going through lately, it feels like you have Swiss cheese brain. Mole. He brings together a pre-Columbian recipe for mole as a metaphor for theology, but he was also a professional dancer. And so if you ever see one of his academic papers, he does ballet, which is really kind of amazingly beautiful. I will not be doing ballet for anybody in an academic
probably conference. Best
not unless I were deep in my cups, which I don't do. At any rate, I went off. I thought I was going to be an actor because I just love it. I love the theater. I love Shakespeare. I love all that kind of performance. And
did you do that in high school or college?
Yeah, I did. I always felt like embodying these parts was another method of, you know, expressing truth. When I was 17 years old, my youth minister was preaching at one of these camps for teenage kids, and the camp was right by my house. So I went to go listen to him. I was very close to him. And he did his work already in me at the age of 15, teaching me how to preach. Well, or he began the process. He had me preach my first sermon at 15. And he would include me in leadership discussions with our youth ministry. Well, at this one event, I could feel this angst, this something gnawing on the inside of me, and I couldn't bring any peace to it. And so at the end of the service, as was the custom, there was this altar call, and I went forward to the side because it wasn't an event for me. It was for other kids. And I just prayed. And I said one of these prayers where I said, God, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. Just make this feeling go away. And so I went down the list. If you want me to stop chasing girls, I'll stop chasing girls. Mm-hmm. But I know that you don't really want me to stop chasing girls. If you want me to be a minister, if you want me to preach, I'll preach. And I know that you don't want me to preach. But when I said that, silly as it sounds, I felt a sense of calm. Mm-hmm. The next week I tell him, I think I'm called to ministry. And he said, duh. The next week I tell my mom, I think I'm called to ministry. She says, oh, I know, honey. And the whole time I'm worried about my dad finding out because I'm, you know, my dad's a practical guy. You know, you can make a better living doing something else. And our church wasn't always easy on our minister. My dad used to stand up for him all the time. So we're having a catch, as they say in Field of Dreams, we're having a catch. And I said to my dad, Dad, I think I'm supposed to be a preacher. And he said, well, I wondered when you were going to figure that out. And it just kept being confirmed by leadership in church. Wow. I went off to school. The educational journey is an interesting one, but I found myself one day in a course with a New Testament scholar who is an expert in the Gospel of John and other Johannine literature. He studied with I. Howard Marshall at Aberdeen. And I thought he was the smartest teacher I had at the school. And so I asked him to be my mentor, and he's the one who started pushing me to read more academic texts. So that's when I started reading N.T. Wright's New Testament, The People of God, and certain books by Bonhoeffer and Barth, his Epistle to Romans. And we would just read these on the side. And I thought back then that certainly, I'm going to go to Aberdeen myself, and I'm going to study New Testament. In fact, he and I took a trip, a group of us students took a trip for 2 weeks and backpacked across Scotland. And I thought I would go to Aberdeen and study, even though Howard Marshall wasn't there any longer. Boy, it'd be a great place to study now. Jeez, they're loaded now. But at any rate,
they do have quite a thing going over there now.
But little did I know that I wasn't as naturally gifted with New Testament as I was with systematic philosophical theology.
Mm. Yeah. So that's what did you kind of settle in on, and how did that take you into the PhD?
Well, I was working as a youth minister in the area where my seminary was, and I thought I would take. So I got accepted to Wheaton and to Asbury and for New Testament, or I was applying to Wheaton and got accepted to Asbury, and again, all New Testament, all pretty evangelical too, by the way. Which I would not really describe myself very evangelical in the common parlance of the term today. Now you go back to the original evangelicals and I don't have any issues. But at any rate, there was at least this one seminary professor who did theology who I really, really dug in my seminary. So I thought, well, I'll just take some courses with him while my girlfriend is in school. And she was studying art college. And during that time, I found out like I was really drawn to philosophy and systematic theology. And genealogies of thought in particular, like how these ideas came to be over time. And what started out as a ministry at one church became a ministry at another church where I would eventually meet my wife. And what started off as a few classes became a master's degree in contemporary theology and philosophy. And there I wrote on the concept of environmentalism as a new religion. And then from there, I had another professor say, hey, look at, what are your plans after all this? I said, well, and you got to fast forward. I'm now married to my wife, and she has two more years in her master's program. So I said, well, I guess I'll just wait two more years, and then I'll apply to go to the University of Nottingham and study with John Milbank. I was very fascinated by the level of creativity of his students and how he did think everything is theology. And so I just knew I could study anything with him, really. And he goes, you know, you can go and study with John right now, part-time. Like, they're pretty forward-thinking at Nottingham there. And so I immediately wrote John Milbank an email and got accepted not that long after, and then began the process of part-time PhD work, which was crazy.
So who were your main kind of theological influences? Tell us about your dissertation, working with John Milbank. I don't know if everyone out there listening knows who John Milbank is. Why don't you orient us a little bit about him and the field that you were working in and some of your theological influences?
Well, Milbank was working in Cambridge in the 90s with people like Graham Ward and Pickstock, and they were basically saying, hey, let's go back to the sources of the scriptures and the ancients and the Cappadocians and the medievals. And in that time in Catholic theology, it was a really big trend to do what's called manualist theology, where you were reading more like manuals, Reader's Digest versions of Aquinas. And they're saying, hey, well, let's take our modern and postmodern questions and let's go back and through all these sources and let's mine the depths of the sources for these questions. And it was a very fruitful time.
In a movement called Radical Orthodoxy.
Yeah, yeah.
A name that,
you know, probably exists to sell books. They used to call it postmodern Augustinianism or something clunky like that. But yeah, the concept of a radical, radix means to go back to the root source. So if you go back to the sources, it's a radical notion. And also if you were Orthodox today, they thought that that would be radical and the other connotation of the word radical. You know, and some people really, really, I mean, for like, there was like a period of time where love or hate, you had to deal with people who came out of this this school. It was never really, as it was conceived of, a very tight school. So it's very diverse, and some people agree with certain people in it and disagree with others. But I knew that at least studying and reading John, there is a way in which you could bring the creative side to theology and study just about any question, which excited me tremendously. And then it took very seriously the sources, which was very exciting for me. But then also he was such a good metaphysician himself that he was thinking about things imaginatively. So by the time I studied with him, I was looking at the question of the concept of the roots of our ecological crisis by very famously produced in 1966, the journal Science by Lynn Townsend White Jr., who has an article that basically makes the argument that the Bible, the Judeo-Christian tradition, has the ideological germ that has infected the West with all sorts of practices and habits and allow cultures to harm the earth. Despotism, writ large from dominion and subdued language. He only thinks well of the Orthodox tradition and Saint Francis in that particular essay, and he doesn't say a ton about them. So I decided I want to approach this question not from an eco-theological point of view, because there is a whole subfield of eco-theology. It's the eco there being kind of an adjectival modifier to theology, and it usually is theology done that's it's been revised. And I just wanted to ask the question, is this really what the Bible says? Is this really what the fathers and mothers and the doctors of the church would say? And ultimately, are there just sources within the ancient faith that are very, very helpful towards the notion of ecological degradation? And so a kind of a quick overview is I analyze not just Lynn White's piece, but the trends in philosophy, religion, and Christian theology that really do put a target on the back of Judeo-Christian sources. And then I ask the question of, is this what Genesis is saying? And I look through the hexameron material of St. Basil and Ambrose and others as they're presenting these creation story accounts through sermons. They're not writing to the academic world. They're writing for everyday people. And the long and short is this is not how they understand those texts at all. And then I really kind of lean into my biggest help, and that is St. Maximus the Confessor. St. Maximus being, as Robert Louis Wilkin calls him and Paul Blowers calls him, the world's most earth-affirming theologian. Mm.
Yeah.
The concept of the one logos is many logoi. So the unveiling of the meaning of God is the thing that gives the meaning to every other thing in creation. And then I also look at creation's destiny and theosis, and through human the human microcosm, all things are being brought into the divine embrace. And then for me, Maximus provides the metaphysical dogmatic structures that I think cross east, west, ancient, medieval. And so what I do then is I take him and synthesize him with Joseph Pieper, the Catholic 20th century thinker, and his leisure as the basis of culture, as a sort of spiritual practice for seeing what Maximus sees. So it's a work in theological seeing or theoria, right? How we see the world and then how we be in the world. And there's even some great little tidbits about play, you know, Homo ludens, a man is the playful creature. Maximus talks about the logos is at play within each and everything in the world. And so there's a sense in which by being people of leisure at play, we can experience divinity. But that comes not through a studying with test tubes in a laboratory. It comes from floating on your back in a lake.
Mm. Which sounds like that. I mean, that really kind of brings together bits of your story as we've been talking about, but also that creative soul that you have, that kind of creative mindset that you have, which I think in my conversations with you really marks you of you come at theology from a slightly slanted angle than a lot of folks who are trained in the Western Academy. Talk to us a little bit more kind of about that, how that has helped you in your own theological journey. And then I'd love to start making some connections to the pastoral journey as well. How has this shaped you as a pastor?
Well, in terms of coming at things maybe in a slant or whatnot, I'm going to say that sounds to me like a very lovely compliment. I hope that is
meant to be. It's meant to be. It is absolutely meant to be.
I'm taking it.
Yes. That is the purpose of it.
You know, let's make it Sunday school for a second and say all truth is God's truth. So if all truth is God's truth, then all things are theological. And then that means that everything becomes a starting point or a conversation partner, which truly excites me. You know, right now I'm doing a lot of reading on the concepts of death, dying, suffering, and, what does the theological project have to bear in those areas of life? But I plan to later on this year, do more on the theology of humor. and the theology of the comedic. And I just think it's such a lovely world that we get to have. Even if I don't produce anything, by that I mean, even if I don't publish anything on this stuff, the fact that I get to think about maybe how God looks on the world and at us and delights, and then the theological endeavor is delighting back, it seems to me to be an incredibly fruitful spiritual prospect.
Yeah, and I think what's I think what's behind my comment is what I sense from you is kind of that almost a pushing against the way that academic theology sometimes circumscribes areas in which we're allowed to do theology, or what we're allowed to call theology. Mm-hmm. And you are definitely someone who tries to push against some of those boundaries, see theology in a different way that is much more expansive than the way that we have, the modern academy has tended to do theology. And I think some of that is, for us as the CPT, it's kind of connected to the pastor theologian vision, is we want to kind of push against some of those boundaries that pastors as theologians have to be competent in a variety of different directions in order to see the world in a particular way and shepherd our people in a particular way. So I see that the way that you kind of embody this vision of the pastor theologian in your theological training and the way that you look at theology and how it lives in the world.
Yeah. And to that, I was once working with a pastor who wrote a book, and the book that he wrote was on Robert's Rules of Order for like church meetings. I don't know if there's anything more soul crushing to a person with my temperament than any rules of order, but it was necessary for work that he was doing, and it was necessary for him leading. He did work on the side with groups. And someone was coming to our church and came up to him and said, you know, in 30 years of parish ministry, this is the one book. And they present him with this book that he written. This is the one book that I pull off my shelf more than any other book. He goes, I have all these systematic theology books and biblical studies books and all these different genre. And I never look at them, but this is one book I use regularly in the ministry. And I mean, for obvious reasons, that makes me very, very sad.
Right.
You know, like that sounds like somebody who's not growing anymore, but I get to kind of put that over here and compare that to my experience on Tuesday evening. My daughter is in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and I took her, and my neighbor, who is the age of my father, he's there, and he's really, really interested in New Age spirituality. And we're able to have a fruitful conversation about many Buddhist tenets and practices, right? And I was showing him how so much of what you find in this Buddhist wisdom literature really does connect with a very ancient form of Christian wisdom literature, and it became this really lovely conversation. And I was only able to have that conversation with him because I'd been studying Buddhism as of late. And that was part of my practice as pastor theologian. I don't have to be an expert in Buddhism, you know, but I am given the task as pastor to try to bring the informed categories of Christian thought and the Christian intellectual practice into conversation, at least, if not critique, conversation, dialogue, depends on what it is, right? I mean, we bring it into critique with our own traditions. So critique isn't bad, I mean, in that regard.
So tell us about your current church context. You're pastoring in the Atlanta area, and of late, you referred to a little bit earlier, you've had some health challenges. Would love to just kind of hear you talk about your journey pastoring right now and kind of what you're learning at this time in your ministry career?
Yeah, I get to serve a church that's nearly 100 years old, right in the middle of Atlanta. It's called Peachtree Christian Church. It's one of the historic disciples congregations in our country. It itself is a medieval Gothic cathedral, or you know, some version of those of those styles. But it, if you look at it, you would think that you were in Europe, perhaps. Yeah. Or
by American standards, a gorgeous building.
You're now living in England, huh? Yes, correct. By American standards, that's very good.
I didn't mean that.
Snobbishness is coming through here.
Gosh, right? I didn't mean that in a pretentious
way, truly. Well, no, it's funny because I have a colleague who's just across the bridge, two blocks, and he's from England. You know, I mean, I love Inglaterra. I mean, I love it there. And I remember the first time I was there, I was taking photographs of old churches, and my professor goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "Taking picture of that church." He goes, "We'll take a picture of an old one. That's a new one." And it was like several hundred years old. I'm from Europe, where the history's from. Anyway, so he likes to cross the bridge and say things like we're a mishmash of British archaeology or whatnot. But it is beautiful. It is delightful. And it's a place that's kind of this whole ground that we're on was the battle site of the Battle of Peachtree Creek. And it's not lost on me or our founders that this whole area of town was spilled blood, countrymen against countrymen, brother against brother. And now it's a place that is redeemed because it's a place that says no unkind word can be said here about anyone's race or religion. And it is a place of prayer for all people. And there is an invitation on the stained glass window facing the great Peachtree Street of Atlanta of Jesus with his hands out saying, "Come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest." So it's meant to be a unifying sort of place. It is in the heart of the Arts District down the road from Georgia Tech. So there is a great deal of STEAM influence as well as arts, and people are highly educated. So it gets to be it's a place where, you know, you have to be able to engage with people on questions that are most pressing to them. It's definitely not the kind of congregation where you can just kind of come in and tell people what we're going to do. You have to lead with them. And it's also got a high population of Jewish brothers and sisters. And across the street is the great temple that was bombed during the 1950s, and we have a historic relationship with the folks of the temple. So that's the area in which I get to serve. As you alluded, I almost didn't make it with some health issues that happened early toward the end of the summer. Liver and kidney failure, and there's a whole host of reasons why, but it made me reassess everything. And I'm still in that process of reassessing. Someone said to me, "What have you learned?" And there's a lot of things to say. There's a lot that I've learned, but the concept of memento mori, think of your death, you know, live in light of your death to prepare your life, you know, to live a good life, is something that you may be able to understand. And then I may be able to teach about it, and that shows a level of understanding. But to let that permeate somehow the inside of you, to go to the deep part of who you are, that is a different thing altogether. And there aren't words that I have yet to describe what that means, except for it's just transformative. You walk out not caring as much, but caring much better about all manner of things. I've undergone spiritual direction in this period of time, and my director said, "I want you to imagine on your walks that you're walking with Jesus." And he said, "The earthy Jesus," you know, not Christ. He wanted me, he said, "The earthy Jesus." And so I'm walking 2.5 loop around the golf course I like to play. And I have music on my AirPods, and I got this whole list of songs that are kind of motivational. To be honest with you, it's like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, like I Won't Back Down. It's stuff like that. I get really super dad cheesy. Like, I'm going to live. I'm going to overcome. I'm going to make it through. And sometimes you gotta have a little cheese in your spirituality, I think. Sometimes it's okay. But as I'm like walking, and I got a little strut because the song, whatever one it was, had a nice beat. And I got a little strut going around this thing, and I'm feeling my strength. And I'm even having thoughts, imaginations, fantasies of these little delusions of grandeur. And I know I'm the only one who ever feels this way.
Of course. Yes.
I look to my right, and there's Jesus. And he looks at me, and he winks at me. He elbows me, and then he puts his arm around my head, and he begins to rub on top of my head. And it's this moment of going, he thinks I'm being funny. Mm. He's making fun of me. Mm. Is it possible that God is kind of making fun of me a little bit? Like, come on, man, you're a little too big for your britches there. Mm. Mm. My feelings weren't hurt. But it was that loving affection of an older brother, somebody saying, I know who you really are. Hey, feel that way. You know, feel the excitement of growing health, you know, but also don't take yourself too seriously.
Mm. It's beautiful. As we, thanks for sharing that with us and kind of bringing us into that part of your journey. And as we close up our time, you know, as you mentioned, you're still processing a lot from your health journey. I wonder, are there some early returns, early results, as far as you're thinking about how this is shaping you as a pastor theologian? What it means for you to be a pastor theologian now as you move into the next phase of life, and Lord willing, God gives you life moving into the future. How do you envision this starting to take shape of what it's going to look like for you to shepherd in light of this?
On a personal affect level, it makes me think of some documentary I was watching about Desmond Tutu, where Desmond Tutu, who's done all this enormous work with apartheid Africa and standing against the injustices, and he's done academic work. In fact, he was a professor here at Candler for a lot of years. And he had the same office as Fred Craddock had, who's one of our heroes and the disciples. So he's got all this weightiness of work that he's done, and I imagine is still doing, yet the documentaries reveal him to be the largest of children. Hmm. A wink and a smile, a tongue sticking out at you and behind a tree hiding while you're taking a photo, trying to make you laugh. The two poles that I hope to occupy on a personal affect side is that I need to speak a whole lot less so that when I speak, it means more. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a seriousness, and then let it be buoyed by this lightness of being. There's that. And then there's the kind of writing that I'm doing. I've always considered myself to be in the systematics world, and I still do. But I think a lot of the writing reading that I'm doing right now might be called spiritual theology, or at least it's more mystical, has more of a mystical tenor. And so I've got mountains of books, and I've got book projects. But even if I write something that's rather systematic and philosophical, I think right now it's always going to lean towards the mystical, which is great for me because I already am enamored with people like Maximus the Confessor and others.
Well, Jared, thanks so much for giving us this time and sharing your journey with us. We're grateful to have you as a CPT fellow, and very grateful that you are strengthening in your health, and we'll continue to be praying for you as you continue that journey. So thanks for joining us.
Well, it's been a ministry of grace to be with you both today, and I hope to be of strength to be able to be with you this summer.
Look forward to it. Take care.
God bless.
Thanks, Jared.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you appreciated this episode, could I ask you to consider sharing it online with others, rating the show on Apple Podcasts, or even leaving a review? It means a lot to us, and it helps others hear about the show. The CPT Podcast is a production of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. The host for today's episode was Joel Lawrence. Our producer and editor is Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.